I don't know how to play, and I don't want to anyway. Need to delete this game and go back to another save. But my hard drive sparked zero charisma, zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of the National Institute for Gamer Review. Talking today about the Chrono Trigger and the early Japanese RPGs, and we are joined by some very special guests, Pitcraft and Borzoi. You all want to say hi?
Yeah, Pitcraft here. Hello.
I should come up with some kind of convoluted JRPG villain monologue about destroying the world because of its imperfections.
No, I've
I just
got
want
one of those
the
ready.
Void. I just demand nothingness to match the nothingness in my soul. I mean, yeah, this is we can get into that. And this is kind of a how to say complicated topic, and I think there's enough here to revisit in the future.
It should be Final Fantasy. It should be like Final Fantasy, where the title implies this should be the last episode, but the series keeps going on. We can do 18 episodes of this, or whatever number they're up to now.
Exactly. I mean, there's tons, obviously, to talk about, and JRPGs are an enormous topic, and one worthy of quite a bit of discussion and analysis, I think. But, yeah.
Can I just kind of hijack this? I wanted to
please.
Ask you guys something on this. Because I feel like when it comes to JRPGs, it's a weird thing you end up getting into, and because of the shift and change that has happened to the RPG video game media genre, it's moving more and more towards action RPGs. So if you didn't grow up on these 80s and 90s JRPGs, it's a little bit, I think it would be a little bit weird for people to kind of go back and play some of them if they don't have that informed, you know, that lived experience of it. So what I wanted to ask you guys is, what was your first experience to a JRPG that made you go, whoa, I like this, I want to play this? I guess for me it was Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, as that's the, I'm trying to think back to the first JRPG I played. It was probably the one that was actually designed to be for beginners.
My first experience was playing was Final Fantasy III or Final Fantasy VI. I guess we could get in a little. For those of you who don't know, there was these were back in the days when it was not clear to publishers, to Nintendo or to the developer Square, that there was much of a market in the United States for this style of game at all, and so there were problems with localization and failure to localize, most famously. So the first Final Fantasy for the regular original Nintendo was eventually localized and released in the States, but the second and third games in the series were not. The fourth,
they were four. And, oh, I see. Okay,
never yeah, the fourth game for the was for the Super Nintendo. And that was localized.
Final Fantasy II, like,
that's right. It was marketed to the North American audience as Final Fantasy II. Then the fifth Final Fantasy, like number 2 and 3 in Japan, was not localized or released or published in the United States. But the sixth was, which was then marketed as Final Fantasy III. But then from 7 on, the numbers have been the same, because with 7 was I don't know if I want to talk about it too much or here, maybe later in the episode or in a subsequent episode, but it was such a massive success, a worldwide success, and it really showed that, you know, incontrovertibly that the market was there and was enthusiastic, and so from then on it's just been the same. But yeah, I don't want to say precisely how old, but I was, you know, fairly young and just absolutely captivated. I had heard, it was actually some kids at school were sort of raving about this the new Final Fantasy. I didn't know any of this stuff, and I had a Super Nintendo, and so I picked it up, you know, at the store with my parents, and I was just immediately blown away. The music, the world, the possibilities for narrative storytelling and world building in an interactive and visual medium really just completely blew me away. And you know, of course, you know, revisiting it even as you know, as an adult, more of a an adolescent teenager, and to say nothing of these days, like, you know, the shortcomings of the stories and the characters, all these kinds of, you know, obvious things in retrospect, or, you know, what's appealing to you or amazing as a child isn't necessarily quite as amazing as you get older. But yeah, I do think there's still quite, you know, it's on all kinds of levels, technological, especially, you know, given the limitations of the time. And particularly, I think I said it already, but the music is something that really, really does stand up very well. Irrespective of the context, but that may just be me.
Yeah.
Anyone else have early experiences?
Well, my first like real experience with any kind of RPG was it was sort of Mana, whatever you want to call it, for the Game Boy Advance. But that wasn't really a JRPG. I later got a hold of a ROM because I'm a Zoomer. For Final Fantasy V, and that was the first JRPG that I just blew through on my own and loved it.
That one's a lot of fun. That one's actually a very underrated game from the series.
Oh, yeah. It's my personal favorite.
Oh, if you guys kind of want to move on, I guess...
Well, Lewis, sorry, do you have... I think I forgot to mention... Lewis is also here, and you have... What was your first experience to this world?
Oh, this is generational, obviously, because I'm a little younger than you guys. My first was... It was a Pokemon Red Game Boy Edition re-release.
Based. Sorry.
Why the hell did I not think of Pokemon?
So I
my first was Pokemon Red. Yeah, no.
Yeah, so I just bounced off of it. I was like, I played some Zelda. I was like, oh, it's like Zelda. Oh, this is not like Zelda. And I just bounced off of it. I had to come back to RPGs later to like kind of get it. At least in terms of JRPGs, for sure.
Yeah,
first one I really got into was Fire Emblem, which is kind of a
a tactical RPG. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's a great one. It's funny that you mentioned. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go on. You go on.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's funny that you mentioned the localization aspect when you're talking to Final Fantasy, because there's gonna be one figure that's going to loom very large over this specific episode, and that's going to be Ted Woolsey, as he's responsible for the translations of a lot of those very important SNES JRPGs, Secret of Mana, Breath of Fire. Final Fantasy VI, obviously, Chrono Trigger, even Super Mario RPG.
There's a Spectre haunting Square.
Well, so this is like, so the Woolsey thing, maybe we can, while we're on the topic, and it is kind of, you know, it's a good kind of background thing to keep track of. Yeah, so I don't speak Japanese, I don't know Japanese, and people who do, there's a kind of, you know, this whole thing goes back to really the early days of fan localization. The 90s, you know, for those of you who may be a little too young or weren't there or were doing other stuff at the time, it was the first, because you had this kind of perfect storm of like computer technology. Where, like, before, you know, you had some anime or whatever coming to the States, but it's not like you could send video files over the internet, right? You just kind of got what you got, and that was that. And you didn't, you know, I believe there were some very, very early fan dubs dealing with, you know, like video recording stuff. But that was just kind of extremely niche, even for an already niche subculture.
Yeah, the history of fan dubs would desire its own podcast, yeah, right. Honestly.
but in the 90s, you had for the first time, like, the ability to send, you know, relatively large files over the internet, a worldwide community of people who are interested in this stuff, and enough knowledge among the fan base, and it kind of built up over the preceding decades to where there was some amount of, you know, intelligent discussion of some of these things. So, yeah, you know, Ted Woolsey... the translator and localizer for Square, like he got a lot of shit even at the time, just a ton of crap from people who didn't even necessarily speak Japanese all that well, or if they did, you know, it's translation is a very fine art, and just because you know the literal meaning of something doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to like reproduce it in a way that's going to be contextually and culturally appropriate for the intended audience.
Which is kind of unique for JRPGs in that there was a sizable minority of people who liked JRPGs in the 90s who would just play them untranslated. That was an option.
That's doable.
And a lot of people did it. Yeah. It's very doable.
There were people who even learned Japanese by playing them and just trying to figure it out based off of that.
Yeah. Arguably, kids who like don't read yet can play JRPGs and do in some edge cases. It's so you don't need to speak any language to play JRPG. It's very simple, and you really can grug your way through it if you're willing to lose a lot of fights, which most kids are.
Yeah. Yeah, the first two Megami Tensei games, for example, there is no plot to speak of, really. The second one has a little. People tell you where to go in that one. The first Megami Tensei game is effectively a straight line.
Well, that's one. I mean, I don't want to. I want to talk about this more later, but you know, the straight line thing is like that's one of the kind of major things about JRPGs in general is they are they tend to be extremely linear.
Yeah. Can I actually get into that a little bit? Because this is the reason why I wanted to come on this episode, DK, was because I was listening to one of your guys' episodes, and one of you had made an allusion to the roots of RPGs. I think you guys might have been talking about it. Must have been the BioWare series and the roots of it with D&D and all that. What's interesting is that the way that people often put JRPGs and Western RPGs as, you know, side by side, these are completely different entities, but the fact is they have the same root source. That's what I find very interesting about that, and also the origins of this stuff. So just briefly, where all this comes from is 18th, 19th century Prussian wargaming. That's really the origins of all of this, because it was the Prussian military officers who wanted to do some wargaming, and they made miniatures, and they would play out battles on that stuff. After the Franco-Prussian War, this actually started to get even more popular because you had this kind of arms race that was going on in Europe and the strong martial tradition that was being created. And so you had more and more various war games being developed. Now, of course, the most famous one at this point is probably Chainmail, which was developed by Gary Gygax. And from that was spun into Dungeons & Dragons. But Dungeons & Dragons, in its origin, was just a war game. There was no idea of, like, putting your party together to go on adventures to defeat some kind of big bad evil guy or anything like that.
Yeah, and before the big Twitter purge, or I guess it was even before that, but the Mia account had a great thread. I wasn't like a huge fan of Mia, but they had a great thread
that thread was so amazing.
Yeah, I hope it's preserved somewhere. I don't know if it is, but it basically went through like this is what old school D&D was, and you know, all this kind of like it's basically just a dungeon crawl, and you and your friends like there's a kind of role playing light aspect. It's all just kind of flavor, and yes, you're doing a little bit of world building and kind of at the edges, but fundamentally it's a certain very specific kind of masculine power fantasy, and that's a good thing. And yeah, that was a great thread. I hope we can find it somehow, or I don't know if.
And incidentally, what's funny is when people go back and read Lord of the Rings, if their only experience of fantasy is D&D influenced fantasy, it can be very jarring and disorienting in some ways, because obviously when Tolkien was writing Lord of the Rings, he wasn't planning to write what would become the template for fantasy. This was just his way of playing with language and mythology and these heroic stories within,
you mean,
you know,
lightly fictionalizing the secret history of Hyperborea, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, yes, absolutely. But anyways, I don't want there's so many different rabbit holes we can go down here. But D&D becomes popular, and then when video games are being when the Japanese market's developing its own computer and console games, they in their origin had to take they took this idea of. You have the random number generator and these mechanics, and you're building a character from D&D. It directly comes from that. But what's interesting about it is that you can see that the way the JRPG developed was probably the result of technical limitations at the time. Because if you look at how Western RPGs developed, they tended to be very dungeon crawl oriented, very, very basic. And they kind of that's the template that's gone for. And they also developed a little bit later than the way that JRPGs exploded, because they were trying to develop an RPG even sooner, you know, to get the full technological push it to its limits. They came up and realized that there was only so much you could do with the technology at the time, and I think that helped move them more towards a storytelling direction, because mechanically there was only so much you could program into it, but
yeah.
It allowed you to try different stories, try different things, and that's why it's kind of remarkable that probably the most well-known, at least JRPG in the West, Final Fantasy, it incorporates a time loop scenario into that, and that's an amazing kind of level of storytelling for something that's so basic from 1986.
Yeah. Also, you notice a lot of the early Japanese RPGs, the kind of defining enemy is like the slime. It's some kind of just random green ball, because that was the level of art you're working with.
Slimes, goblins.
Yeah. Also, you notice that the entire Western RPGs were also text based at the same time. So it was a whole different ball game.
Yeah, Rogue being a big one was completely just representation through keyboard keys, basically. ASCII characters. Because it's funny that the roguelike has become such a ubiquitous genre now.
That's one of the things
I love roguelikes, but if anyone likes roguelikes, go look at how the original Rogue was played, and it's still being played to this day. You have Grognards you can get updated skins of Rogue, but you have thousands of Grognards who will never, ever update to that. They're going to stick to the same Rogue that they played when they were in university in the 1980s.
What are you, some kind of UI cuck? Yeah.
Dwarf Fortress Bros stay winning.
Exactly. Well, now Dwarf Fortress apparently has a graphical interface, or at least optionally.
Yep.
So, on that note, I think, you know, this is something we've said before, but I just want to make the point again very briefly, is part of the promise or you know, the kind of the hype, when people talk about interactive entertainment is, you know, this idea that, like, now you can kind of go anywhere and do anything in this digital world. That's never really been true. I highly doubt that it's ever going to be true. You're always going to be in some kind of a walled garden, just given the way that programming works, or like the internet work, you know, the everything works. Like, I mean, the idea, I mean, I guess the dream maybe is a kind of endless procedurally generated content that is also compelling. I'm, you know, huge X the doubt on whether that's ever even really going to be technically possible, just given how, like, reality is at a certain level. And so then there's this question of, like, okay, well, to what extent are we going to try to provide players with a compelling illusion of that kind of freedom versus, you know, to what extent are we going to be kind of an on-rails theme park ride type experience? And yeah, I think, you know, broadly speaking, Western RPGs tend towards trying to give that illusion of openness, tend towards that kind of open world game design that we see popularized now now that we're fully in the action RPG world with things like, you know, the Assassin's Creed series and things like this, versus the classical era of JRPGs, and even really, I think, beyond. I haven't played Ni No Kuni, or I haven't really played any very contemporary JRPGs, but my understanding is they still stick pretty closely to this very linear formula, which then frees you up, you know, in terms of design trade-offs, to tell a more, at least in theory, to be able to tell a more compelling story. Because you're able to set the pacing more concretely. You're able to set these things. You know, you know what's going to happen and the order in which it's going to happen. You're not as concerned with all these interacting systems necessarily. And so if you're sophisticated, you can do more sophisticated narrative things than you would in a kind of more open design.
I'm really glad this is the last thing I'm going to say, and I'm going to let other people talk, because I want this mechanic thing is actually very important for me. I want to lay down the groundwork on this, because that's a great point you bring up. There's three series, I'd say, right now that are carrying that are still carrying the torch for the old JRPG style. And that's Persona, Ni No Kuni, and I blinked on what the other one I was thinking of was, but so I'm not going to worry about it right now. But
Tales of Berseria, maybe? Or whatever, Tales?
No, because those are action RPGs. The issue that they ran into is that there's always going to inevitably develop towards action RPGs, because you want to have that more dynamic, exciting gameplay, because this is actually what led to the development of the action time system, where it's still turn-based, but there's a little bit of speed and randomness.
Let's talk about this for just a second mechanically. Or do you want to?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Because otherwise, what you end up happening is you have a solely turn-based strategy type system. It just becomes a pure strategy game. So you have to add a little bit of dynamism to it and a little bit of randomness to it to keep it exciting. And unfortunately, it's hard to keep making games in that style when the development is either, well, it would make more sense to either just go pure turn-based or pure action RPG. And what you're seeing with the development of at least like series like Persona is they're giving you a little bit of an action RPG feel, but the battles are still being done by turn-based, and they found a way to make them still exciting.
Yeah, so when we talk about turn-based versus like this, I think in Final Fantasy they call it active time battle, or at least that was how it was marketed in the Super Nintendo days, was, yeah, you know, in a strict turn-based system, it's just essentially like, you know, you're playing chess, right, where you have, you know, you move, and then the other, your opponent has, in principle, however long they want to move. Then I guess the active time battle is a little bit like speed chess, right, where you have a clock, where, like, you know, once your character is ready to move, then, you know, you can move, but if you don't, then the enemy continues to be able to act.
Yeah, you have to react with it.
Right, and it was conceived as a kind of way to, like, rather than just sort of sitting around and, you know, okay, this character has a turn and that character has a turn, then it's kind of a, you know, quasi, it's a little bit more, you know, of a fast-paced type thing, but it still ends up being...
There's a little more Skinner box involved too, right? You can't, like, go get a drink. You got to be, you know, focused up.
Definitely.
Whereas, but, like, right now with Persona, I could have it on the background in the middle of a battle and be doing this podcast because I'm just waiting to do and take my character's turn.
Right.
Yeah. What I think is, like, most interesting about the, like, turn mechanic itself is that, like, Persona, and to a much greater degree, like, the Megami Tensei series, the way they've done it is instead of, you know, being a set turn of you get, you know, four actions for each party member or whatever, it's you have to play well to get extra turns, or you lose, basically. Because they use, like, a press turn system that if you do something good, you get half of a turn back, or something like that.
Yeah, the Persona series actually employs this very well with the baton system, where if you hit the enemy's weakness, you have a chance to take another turn or to pass it on to another player, another character, so you're able to build combos out of this. This is where I find the design philosophy of JRPGs interesting, because in order to stand out, you have to have an interesting battle. You either have to have a really good story, and those are increasingly harder to write, or you have to have a really fun battle system, and that's a big reason the lack of good stories and the lack of an exciting battle system is a big reason that led to the decline of the JRPG for quite some time.
Yeah, you can't just crunch numbers for your game, because there's only so many times you can run the Excel spreadsheet before you understand it.
Well, it's also, I mean, not to, like, go super too far afield on this, but I had a kind of aha moment one time. So Penny Arcade, the webcomic about games, had a kind of abortive attempt at video game design of their own. They made an RPG, and it's actually kind of, maybe, I don't know, at some point we could discuss in a little more detail. They switched design kind of halfway through the series, after they basically were not able to finish it on the way they had initially envisioned. And the people who finished, they handed it off to another development studio, the same people who made, I think, Cthulhu Saves the World and some kind of, like, some of these kind of 8-bit graphic style, you know, throwback RPGs. Like, you know, it's made, you know, in contemporary equipment, you know, design stuff, but it's all very kind of 8-bit and or 16-bit in its graphics and kind of approach. And there was a point where on the Penny Arcade blog, the guy was like, you know, well, one of the things we wanted to do was include difficulty settings because, you know, I don't know, it's like a sop to modern game design. So, you know, if you want to just kind of blow through it and see our writing, because that was one of the major appeals was you know, the writing of the thing, you can do that. Or if you want to feel like you're being crushed between two Excel spreadsheets, like, you can have that experience as well. And just the way that he put it, it was kind of funny, but I was thinking about it, I was like, yeah. You know, it's funny how, like, you know, so much of the grind in in these kind of games where you because it's not an action experience, because your input as a player is you know always mediated through these numbers that you only have a kind of indirect influence over, like the way that you kind of become more powerful is you just do the same repetitive action over and over again. And if you're compelled, you know, or you have that kind of gamer autism drive to want to do that, then, you know, people will spend, I mean, I remember once we were, I was playing in college with some friends, we were playing Final Fantasy VII during exam time, and we sort of handed off the controller to each other, I don't know how many times over a span of, you know, a week or two, just to basically be running 24/7 leveling up so that we could fight and defeat all the weapons, these kind of optional super bosses that are way harder than anything else in the game, including the final boss of the main story, just to kind of be able to say, you know, that we did it. And that's what you would have to do. But the thing is, like, from a certain perspective, it's like, you know, what are you even doing, right? Especially you're spending all this time and effort just kind of doing the same thing. I did the same thing on my own in the Final Fantasy V, beating the ultimate super boss that, you know, is kind of optional, just leveling up everybody over and over again, just getting that Excel spreadsheet number all the way where it needed to be so that I could do it. And it's kind of, you know, at a certain point when you take a step back, it's like, what am I really doing here?
Yeah, I mean, that's the what you end up seeing as well. The rot ends up entering into Western RPGs as well with the rise of the MMO RPG, which it fundamentally has the exact same problem. It gets to the point of why am I crunching numbers? D&D doesn't have that issue because it's a constantly evolving dynamic game that you're playing with people you know. So changes and adjustments can be made easily on the fly, and oftentimes games don't even make it to their final endpoint. A campaign typically collapses due to people not being able to commit to it because there's a fallout, or because of, like, on the very special rare occasion it happens, the campaign actually ends with everybody getting to the end.
And one thing I've noticed, I haven't had so much this experience, but I have seen it, and it kind of makes a certain sense. And a lot of I've seen a lot of people sort of talk about this when you're actually doing D&D, like, because that there's so much emphasis nowadays when you're playing on this kind of narrative progression rather than just kind of, you know, this dungeon crawling type aspect. Inevitably, if a D&D campaign goes on long enough, basically you just end up killing a higher and higher power level of deity until you basically, like, killed all the gods and become supreme god yourself, and that's, like, at that point, it's like, what do you even have left to do, right? But that's kind of like the end game, typically.
You can actually kind of see this as almost like a Faustian expression type thing, because you see this in anime and you see this in video games. Anything that requires a progression of something, the inevitable question is like, okay, well, what? Like, I beat the big guy with the big number. Okay, what's the next big guy with the big number that I need to beat? And inevitably, it's going to end up being the gods you have to fight.
Right. Yep.
Dragon Ball Z fell into the same problem, and it's actually, incidentally, I mean, we're going to be talking about Akira Toriyama a little bit as well. Because
why don't
of his
we? Why, actually, that's a great segue. Why don't we? Why don't we bring this around a little bit to Chrono Trigger, right? Which was, I don't know, how would you characterize the release of Chrono Trigger? I mean, it was an earthquake. I think it was. It was enormous, and yeah, it was not the. Well, it was the, this was, I guess, also worth mentioning in terms of the timeline. It was released in the United States in 1995. Final Fantasy VI was released the previous year, in 1994, I believe. So, I mean, just think about that in terms of, you know, what that, like, what was going on at the time, and how quickly these things were following. They had a lot of the same. Personnel involved. I know Hironobu Sakaguchi, the lead designer of Final Fantasy, was involved in Chrono Trigger. Do you want to jump in?
Well, yeah. I mean, the game was for people who were into the business and of video games and the personalities. It was notable for having what they called the Dream Team, which was a lot of people think Masato Kato was one of he who would go on to do a lot of games like Xenogears and. Like, he actually wasn't a member of the Dream Team, because this is actually the game that he really kind of cut his teeth on. But the Dream Team was Akira Toriyama on the art, Nobuo Uematsu who I believe assisted.
He was on the music.
It was because like, this is another game where this is associated with Yasunori Mitsuda, but Mitsuda wasn't. Like, this is the game he cut his teeth on, basically. Yuji Horii, who did the storyline for it, Kazuhiko Aoki. I'm not sure what he did. Yeah, I think he was just a producer. And then, of course, Hironobu Sakaguchi, who did a lot of the design for it. And so you had this dream, again, dream team that came together and made this game. And I think what was notable about it and why it made such a splash, I'm trying to remember if it came out before or after Final Fantasy VI. I think it came after.
Yeah,
it came right after. So people had gotten to the use of the epic scope of a game like Final Fantasy VI, which had so many different characters, and it was very much in that Final Fantasy style. And then this game comes along, and it limits your characters to, I think, if you play it the way most people play it, it maxes out to about 7. They team up together to do different techniques. This was a new thing with the way they incorporated the active time battle system, because now it was, I don't need to wait. When one character is ready, I don't need to go. If I wait for another character, or even all three characters to go, they can do a super attack all together.
There was also, real quick on this, it was a little bit dipping into tactical waters. Unfortunately, the design never completely coalesced in this direction to include like the physical, like geometric layout of the battlefield. But there was some attention paid to, like, you know, certain attacks run in straight, so you attack enemies that are in a line or enemies that are close together, or one at a time. It didn't end up really mattering all that much tactically in terms of the battles, but at least it was there.
And there also wasn't really any random battle, because it used to be on the map, but yes, the map would shake and suddenly you're into a random battle. No, you could see the enemies on the map, and so you could actually try and plan out ways. They would incorporate environments into this to try, and you could throw enemies off, you could avoid battles, you could sneak around. These were not ideas that were fully fleshed out, but they're incorporated into the game, which made it seem so different and so special. And there's a lot of other things about it, but I want to make sure everybody else has a chance to speak about it. So there's some other stuff I want to talk about the game, though. But before I go, I want to make sure everybody else has a chance to jump in here.
Lewis, you've been kind of quiet. What do you have any? So I guess you hadn't played Chrono Trigger before, had you?
Yeah, I was. I actually had. It was one of those things that I always kind of wanted to go back to, but there hadn't been a good re-release until relatively recently. I bought the game for $5, and I'm kind of slamming through it. It's fun. I was actually going to bring it up. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, what are your thoughts on it, like playing it now from this kind of... Because I've been hesitant to play it. I think I would still enjoy it as much as I've always enjoyed it. Every time I've gone back to the game, the enjoyment level is still the same, but I always wonder how people who didn't have this obsessive love I had for the game, when they come back to it, or if they play it for the first time, what their perspectives
I have a really interesting comparison. It's kind of like watching Seinfeld, in that like observational comedy and this kind of talky sitcom thing is like basically what all shows are these days, and you're kind of going back to the roots of it, so a lot of things feel like I've played this game a million times kind of. But I do appreciate it's doing some things well. I found some things. I'm not all the way done, but it is. It seems to have a very modern balance of not being very grindy, relative to its, games of that era, and that feels like very modern and very kind of masterful. I haven't caught myself grinding yet. Occasionally I have to use more items, you know, in a battle than I want to, but I've never had a thing that I just couldn't get past and had to, like, back up and fight a bunch of rats.
Balancing that aspect of a game is always, like, hit or miss depending on the game, and there's no real way to know until you've played through it, kind of the issue with that. And they actually did an incredible job, and...
Yeah,
I think it's weird that they included ways to grind there easier.
Well, they sequestered it, right, behind... So, like, in terms of the overall design of Chrono Trigger, one of the many innovations that they did along these lines was basically they drew a hard line between the kind of main narrative and the end game content. And that I think in itself kind of like the idea of an end game where like, okay, you've completed just about everything and now we're going to give you, that's where I guess also the non-linearity mostly comes up, is like, okay, here's a series of kind of end game tasks that you can tackle or not in, in sort of whatever order you want to. And then on top of that, there was like, okay, well now in addition to that, because basically the idea is, especially on a first playthrough, that, you know, really if you want to beat the final boss and not have too hard of a time of it, you're going to need to do all that end game content. But just beating the final boss on, you know, on your first playthrough isn't really the end, because they incorporated a number of alternate endings. Well,
this is the game, I think, that if it didn't introduce it, it popularized it.
It was the first time
that introduced New Game Plus.
Right. And there was no New Game Plus ever prior to this. This Chrono Trigger literally invented the concept of New Game Plus.
Yeah, it's hard to, if you didn't play this game when it first came out, because of how much, it's just like what Lewis was saying, is that you can see the, you can go back and watch Seinfeld and not find it funny, and maybe you can even understand on an intellectual level, okay, well, this is, they built the foundations of modern comedic shows with this. If you didn't play Chrono Trigger at the time and having only had the experience of previous JRPGs, it is hard to understate what a revolutionary game this was. You would be playing this, and that's, okay, so I got time travel plot going on here. That's pretty cool. I'm jumping back and forth between time, but because you're used to this linear progression, it breaks off at the point when the main character dies. This is,
yeah, right. That, yeah, I forgot to. Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah,
the main character dies in the game, and then you're kind of left on your own. And they basically they heavily suggest you in the direction you're going to go. That's going to bring back Chrono, and then you go finish the game.
Really, if you want to progress in the game, like the first thing you should do is get your main character back.
But you don't actually have to do that. You do not actually have to do that. You can actually finish the game without the main character, and that's when a lot of people discovered, oh my god, there's multiple endings to this. And so you have this fun linear time travel game, and they find this clever way of actually incorporating time travel into an interesting way, because at that point, and this really only becomes possible with the New Game Plus, where I assume people will have to know what that is, but you start the game over, but with everything you had previous before, so you're as powerful as you were when you previously beat the game. Well, now you can go and beat that, because it's a time travel game. You can travel to any time and beat that boss, and you see a different ending that develops out of that. And if that was just, I can't understand this.
Not just that,
how,
I mean,
amazing
that
was.
There's my personal favorite in terms of that design element. There are two kind of critical story beats. One occurs very early. It's actually basically the first thing that happens in the story, where before you even have, because the game, you have three party members essentially, you know, three people that you can have in your party, and before you even get your third, it's just you and one other character. You can go like the whole thing, basically the plot revolves around, there's this fair, and there's this inventor who who's showcasing this invention at the fair. The invention is essentially a teleporter. And you, the main character, this kind of teenager, Dragon Balls, you know, Goku looking guy, you know, you run into this girl accidentally, and she kind of decides, oh, I like this guy, you know, we're just going to kind of, you know, hang around the fair and have a good time. She volunteers to go through the teleporter machine, and something goes wrong and she disappears, and the game kind of proceeds from there. The thing is, you can hop in the teleporter before that story event and fight the final boss of the game, just the two of you. And this is like this is very clearly the hardest of the things to do. And you get a kind of special bonus where, you know, you there's a so-called designer room, and you can talk to the designers of the game, have like kind of pre-programmed things that they say in relation to the story. But you can essentially, like, before the game even starts, you can end it on a New Game Plus. The other thing you can do is there's a kind of very common narrative thing where, you know, you go up against this final boss and lose. He defeats the party. The thing is, unlike, and this is much later in the game, the thing is, unlike, you know, most games of this genre, where essentially it's hard-coded that you lose, or, you know, the either through the boss having you know, impossible to beat statistics, or just it's literally a cutscene or something like that. The statistics of the boss in that fight are much harder than, or much higher than the actual boss that you play at the end of the game. It's a much harder fight, like irrespective of your level, and your level is a lot lower at the time. But on a New Game Plus, and probably not on your first New Game Plus, it took me, I don't know, maybe, I mean, I also love the game, I didn't mind, but it was a couple rounds through the game to get a high enough level with good enough equipment for everybody that, you can beat the boss, that the final boss of the game, at a higher, you know, at a higher difficulty than the actual final boss of the game midway through the story when you're supposed to lose.
Yeah, and the, like, reasoning for why the stats are different also makes sense in context,
which
adds to the story.
Right. Yeah, it's really just extremely well designed at every level.
One experience that I really enjoy that was not, I don't say like utterly new to me, but that no one had ever kind of spoiled it because it was kind of minor. But obviously, when you're playing the JRPG the first time, you kind of just like click on everything and go talk to every person, do every little thing. So in the fair, I like clicked around, did a bunch of stuff. And then later on, there's a point where your character's on trial for kidnapping.
Yeah.
And it just busts you for doing all the JRPG things.
It's like yeah, you go, you lunch. Took this person's food? It's like, you thief?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. It's like, I really enjoyed that. Because, I mean, other games have done that, but I could definitely tell this is the first one to do it. And it really does, like, it. I was playing a JRPG like you play a JRPG, and it really punished me for it, and I really appreciate it.
Another thing
along
those...
funny is they actually have, like, story reasons for why the events still play out if you purposefully do everything not wrong. And that just shows you, like, how well they thought it out.
Yeah, they designed around, like, because obviously your first time through the game, you're going to, like, take the apple and you know, do the, not necessarily
the cat,
return the cat, exactly. Yeah. And then, but then, you know, on subsequent playthroughs, you'd be like, oh, I wonder what happens if I don't do all those things that were used as evidence against me at trial. And you know, they're like, yeah, well, too bad. You still have to go to jail. But there's some bonuses. The other thing along those lines, which again is just a really nice little touch that shows you just how much thought went into this. So as we mentioned, obviously the name Chrono, you know, Chronos is the Greek word for time, and time travel figures hugely into the story. And you're bouncing around different eras in the world, from kind of a prehistoric era with dinosaurs and cave people to like a far, you know, kind of like a ancient Hyperborean, hyper-technical ancient civilization that disappeared, to, you know, the far future with robots and this kind of stuff. If you there's a point where you especially like kind of earlier in the game where you're in like a medieval type period where there is some, you know, nice equipment in chests, some kind of valuable stuff. And if you play through with the typical kind of JRPG thing of like, oh, look, there's a chest. I'm going to open it and take what's inside. Thank you, chest. The thing is, if you don't do that, then because these powerful items are sitting in these chests for several hundred years, if you go into the future, you can go to the same chest and take a more powerful version of that same item that's there. But if you raid that chest in the past, then it won't be there in the future.
That's how real weapons work in real life, by the way.
Clearly.
If you bury a gun in a box for your great-grandson, when he opens it, it's going to be an even more powerful gun.
I mean,
then if you send him back in time, he can dual-wield them and be incredibly cool.
I guess the other notable thing this game did as well is it even also created a optional character in the form of a villain you fought earlier, Magus.
Yeah, like that's...
Yeah, Piccolo.
It's hard to, like... I mean, again, I don't know...
It is funny how much, like, you could see... So, I don't think we really mentioned Akira Toriyama did all the character designs for this. It was hilarious when I watched Dragon Ball Z for the first time, looking at, like, thinking, like, why did these all look like Chrono Trigger characters?
Yeah.
Oh, I had a similar, more modern, because I played it recently. I was like, oh, that's where the meme, some of those frog memes came out of, from, like, 2016. There were a lot of, like, JRPG frog memes around, like, the frog era. It's like, oh, that's the frog. Huh. Funny.
Best character of the game, by the way.
Yeah.
Comes back in the sequel, kinda.
I don't want to. We don't talk about Chrono Cross. No, well, maybe another time. Maybe another
time. The most notable thing about Chrono Cross is how much of a fuck you it was to the original game. At least that's how I always interpreted
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I just don't know what to make of it. I hated it.
It's like, everything you did was for naught because Lavos transcends time itself. He's space and time.
It's the Macross sequel Macross versus Robotech for Chrono Trigger and Chrono Cross. It's that kind of situation, I feel.
You have to explain that analogy better.
So the analogy is kind of bad because Robotech isn't like a sequel. It's more of like a translation. But the key thing is that it was the same kind of story done by entirely different people.
Yeah, the guy Carl Masek, basically took a hatchet to Macross and turned it into a completely different series to try and make it palatable.
Yeah, and like two other series.
Yeah. Try and make it palatable to Western audiences.
And then Chrono Cross was just remixing Chrono Trigger into a mess.
Or something, I don't know, yeah. We could talk about it another time. I played through Chrono Cross once, blew through it, and I was like, what the fuck is this? And never touched it again, and I didn't... I hardly understood it at the time, and remember even less of it now. But we can maybe do another thing on that at some other time. I want to I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much of our audience is people who are doing a nostalgic thing of like, oh shit, I remember these games were fucking awesome, versus maybe people who haven't necessarily played this stuff before. People who are fans of some of the later JRPG or later video games who haven't necessarily played the particular titles that we're mentioning. As far as Chrono Trigger itself, yeah, like the Magus thing. So I guess maybe to do a kind of 10,000-foot overview of the plot. Sorry, Lewis, and sorry for spoilers. I'll try to do as little spoiling as possible.
I don't mind. It's a million-year-old game.
Yeah, but basically. Well, I hopefully there are other people who would be interested in playing it for the first time too. So I'm gonna try to be a little careful, but basically, like the whole kind of first part of the game is it's set up that you it's clear that like one of the things you learn very early on is that the world ends, and you're sort of the goal of the game is to stop the world from ending. Pretty normal JRPG stuff.
Which is actually funny, considering the politics we're in now, that you have these very forward looking people who. 1,300 years into the future, they want to make sure the world doesn't end, whereas we're dealing with people who can't even think a generation ahead. And think
or save the world, kind of a cuck move, dude.
Yeah, and there's cool stuff about it.
Let them die of their own hubris.
Risking your life for women who haven't even been born yet, you fucking simp.
Simp. No, this maybe actually we could dwell on this for a minute, because it actually is kind of interesting how, The whole, you talk about, we got some graph Twitter OGs here in, today. Like, the what kicks the game off, really, is...
it's pure simping.
It's a... well, that too. Right, so this girl disappears, you go to find her. In the course of finding her and trying to rescue this girl who disappeared for kind of unclear reasons... you basically, TLDR, the reason she disappears, and this isn't really a spoiler because it's like the first hour or less than an hour of the game, is she was transported into the past. And so you go into the past to try to rescue her, and then in the course of that you realize something's up with the time-space continuum, something like there's a disturbance here. What is the disturbance? And you get a vision of the world ending in 1999, which is kind of funny because the game supposedly takes place in the year 1000, and in the game kind of world, our world, it was released in 1994 or 1995, and the world ends in 1999, which is kind of interesting as just like a general matter, and it ends in this kind of some kind of nuclear apocalypse, and everything is blown up and completely destroyed, and collapse very much figures into it, because then in the future of 2300 AD, after a couple hundred years after this nuclear holocaust of complete destruction, just about everything, the only thing that's left is blown out husks of civilization, and you're kind of traveling through the ruins of this. At one point you're sort of flung into this future, this post-apocalyptic future, trying to accomplish your objectives in this post-apocalyptic future. The thing is, you are led to believe for, I don't know, the first third or so of the game, that the reason why the world ends, it's clear that it's this, it's, we mentioned Lavos, this kind of like interdimensional being of great power and terror that that launches the essentially what amount to these nuclear missiles that that destroy the world. You believe that there's this very powerful sorcerer, Magus, who summoned Lavos for kind of unclear reasons. And so you
the only inclination you're given to that is because when you go to 600 AD, he's in he and the monsters are
the
in
race
this war. With the,
yeah, right. There's
they're
a
in
race
a race war,
war
with the humans.
Such
humans
cool,
of the north.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, exactly. There's a race war between humans and monsters. We forgot to make. There's all kinds of cool stuff going in here. And each like time era has its own kind of
Each era has its own conflict.
Yeah.
So you're basically meant to infer that the that Magus summoned Lavos because they were involved in this human monster race war.
And so you interrupt Magus at the point of doing this, and spoiler alert, turns out that's not exactly what's going on. And then if you desire, and it's actually kind of an interesting moment because you can later on, you know, you can fight him and essentially kill him and if you want to get your revenge on him for all the bad stuff he did to you.
Oh, and the other reason why fighting him becomes a thing as well is because one of your party members, Frog, was turned into an anthropomorphic frog.
Yeah, he has like a personal vendetta. Exactly, yeah. But you don't have to do that. You can actually have him join your party as a very powerful, like the most powerful magic user in the game. And this was all, again, I mean, for there, you had kind of like quasi, you know, Final Fantasy VI is the immediate point of comparison because it was released a year prior and was, I think in many ways, or at least to me, it's kind of the, maybe this is my, you know, whatever, rose-colored glasses from being a fan of it, but I think it was the pinnacle of that particular type of JRPG, of the kind of very sweeping, grand, you know, story of, you know, like I don't know how to say it. It's another, ultimately Final Fantasy VI is another kind of save the world story, but it doesn't have the humor, it doesn't have the same level of kind of, you know, personalization.
I mean, it's got the humor if you got the Wolseley translation, so
it has some funny moments.
Submariner,
yeah, the son of a, yes, he's a very famous line by Kefka, he says son of a submariner, and there's a couple others that I have to remember for a second. Yeah,
but I think
Final Fantasy 5.
I know what you're saying though, because they both games have an epic scope, but in Final Fantasy 6 you go into the world is ruined. You go into the world of ruin, and you have this epic battle against Kefka at the end, who's just, all he is just a genocidal god wannabe. I mean,
I wouldn't call him genocidal. He's omnicidal, really.
Okay, yeah, true.
He wants everything gone.
He just wants to destroy all life. He's basically the Japanese version of the Joker. Is really what he is. But there's a lot of you know, there is weight to that. But what I liked about Chrono Trigger is because there's just something that seems very unreal about the omnicidal maniac. It's just because that person, just that's an archetype of something that doesn't even really exist. But there's a lot more human drama, I think, present on the smaller scale in Chrono Trigger, and you are basically struggling against what you can either call a force of nature or a cosmic horror. And I think that feels a little bit more real. And it even leads to these existential discussions that the characters occasionally have. This is not the kind of deeply philosophical game that you'll see later on in series like Persona, or with Jungian psychology, or with the Xeno Gears and Xeno Saga series, which has a very interesting perspective on Christianity and not...
It's basically Evangelion, the video game.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Gnostic Christianity. But the characters have these... like, these quiet conversations about death and existence and where Lavos came from and the struggling against a natural they don't even know if it's natural or unnatural, this life form they don't quite understand that only they even remark at one point that it's reproducing itself and it's going to continue spreading across the galaxy. It's just doing what it by its nature does.
That's the thing. It's sort of like the I wouldn't exactly call it a big reveal, and it's kind of, so much of Chrono Trigger is about the interplay between the characters, and yeah, you know, having two characters in your party who are like essentially mortal enemies, and stuff like this. But you know, to an extent, and this was kind of at the time why, I mean, I really love Chrono Trigger, and I probably played, I you know, more hours were spent by me playing Chrono Trigger than Final Fantasy VI. I desired a more kind of, I don't know, there was something about that kind of grand, high fantasy, sweeping thing that appealed to me at a certain level, more so at the time, at least. And yeah, to me as a kid, it was a little bit, I don't know, somewhere between dissatisfying and just like, you know, I wanted something more, because now I actually kind of look at it oppositely. But yeah, it's revealed that Lavos, the final boss, the end of the game, this thing that caused this nuclear apocalypse, is essentially just like a space seed. It just arrived, arrived one day, and it just came to your planet and burrowed in. It gathered power from the Earth's core over millennia until it was powerful enough to like just do its thing and release its nuclear missiles. And what is this?
Remembered something. I can't remember if it's just alluded to or if it's confirmed, but he came. It's implied that he was summoned to Earth by the dying, because there's another race war that's going on between the reptilian dinosaurs and the cavemen human beings. And so when the dinosaurs know that their time is coming, I think it's implied that they basically summon Lavos as a fuck you to the humans.
I don't know.
They talk about the orange star or whatever.
Yeah, it's
the
like
sky.
About to hit. Yeah, exactly. I don't know if they summon it or not. It's an interesting, or that might also
be
a good translation.
They know what it is, though, and they gloat.
Yes,
they're
aware, and they're like, "Look, you think you're going to win?" Because that's the thing: you fight the dinosaurs, and eventually you help the humans win. And then as the dinosaur king is like dying, he's like, "Yeah, but you're fucked because this thing is coming, and there's nothing you can do about it." And that's like implied to be
they cope.
Implied, yeah, I guess it's one of the funny kind of many kind of winking things that they do with the fantasy world of like, this is the meteor that wiped out the dinosaurs was actually Lavos. Like, the dinosaurs have been wiped out by the cavemen with your help, but the meteor that wiped out the dinosaurs in like, you know, according to science or whatever, is actually Lavos who came in at that time and then burrowed deeply into the ground. And yeah, and then later, late in the game, you fight like these Lavos spawn, because later on in you know, once he's almost ready to reveal himself, he like spawns other Lavoses that are going presumably to go do the same thing to other planets. And like, I mean, you don't see any of that, you're not aware of any of that, but it's an interesting question of like, that's the thing, I guess, is Lavos isn't really, it's very much, I think you're right on the nose, Borzoi, in terms of presenting it as cosmic horror, almost kind of like in a Lovecraft thing of like, this is just an immensely powerful being that reproduces by obliterating planets and spreading its spawn across the universe, and it's not aware of you, it doesn't care about you, it has no idea like about any of this stuff, it's just doing its thing, right?
Yeah, which
you didn't save the universe, you just saved one planet, and
right,
it could come back.
In fact, actually, we know in the sequel he's beyond time thanks to what Scala did. But anyways, the other thing that kind of like also inches it's a little bit in the gray area of a cosmic horror thing, because it is something from space and it is horrifying and it has a nature that is very imperceptible to us. But there's often, at least with the great old ones, there's this implication that they have a certain kind of consciousness. Now it's a consciousness that's alien to us, and we're just incidental to all of that. But with Lavos, he's literally just a force of nature. He is a creature that feeds on planets, reproduces, and sends them across. Who knows where that came from? How did such a thing even evolve? The fact that this came out of, we don't know if this is natural or unnatural, and that's what kind of adds to the spooky element of it, because he could just be an evolved force of nature, could also have been created in a lab somewhere.
Who knows,
could also just be an actual cosmic deity of some kind. You don't really know.
One thing that like about that I think is kind of adding to the cosmic horror element is that the end of time is a place you go to, and they still want you to solve the Lavos issue there. The end of time, where Lavos isn't around, they still want you to go back and deal with it. And they help you on your quest to do that in various ways.
Yeah, of course, you could also make if you wanted to debate that, like you just make the argument that it's because Gaspar's he's from Earth, and he's from the time period that actually tried to harness the power of Lavos to disaster.
It's been a while. Yeah, so it's been a while since I played. I'd have to like go back over the script or something, but I kind of remember that it's vaguely implied, like, because, so it's like, on the one hand, yeah, time, the end of time is a place you go, and it's kind of like, yeah, it's the end of time, and time just kind of ends. I could just be making this up, or maybe it was an implication, or I'm not sure, but I believe it's sort of vaguely implied, like, the reason why there's this nothingness at the end of time is because of Lavos. Like, there would be more here if it weren't for this thing, this is, or in any case, that, yeah, that, like, as you say, that there's this disturbance in this space, there's this thing that's messing up time, and that's Lavos, and we you know, there's a problem that needs to be solved. Anyway, I don't want to go necessarily too deep. I mean, I think if it isn't clear by now, it should be, and I hope we haven't ruined this too much or spoiled too much for people who haven't necessarily played.
It's like a 25-year-old game now.
Yeah, and it's still so deep that there's tons of stuff we haven't even touched.
Well, yeah, I'm trying deliberately to avoid mentioning everything, but yeah, definitely, yeah, if you haven't, this is definitely something worth playing if you haven't, if you're at all into anything, if any, you know, any of these genres are appealing to you.
I want to before we close out on Chrono here, what I find interesting, and I think this has actually only added to the reputation this game has had, is that for such a successful game, and I know they had a lot of different personalities involved, and it may not be easy to get all those personalities back together, but for such a revolutionary game, it only had one sequel, which was Chrono Cross. Now there's another game that's related to that, Radical Dreamers, which serves as a kind of prequel to Chrono Cross. But for a company that is shitting out Final Fantasy named titles, you know, by the day, this is a remarkably untouched series. It's actually kind of crazy. Now, I think a big reason for that is they wouldn't want to do anything else without Akira Toriyama involved, because it's the same reason why they won't do a Dragon Quest game without him. It's just his art is just so iconic for these games. But it is strange that they've never done another Chrono game, and it kind of gives the game a little bit of a timelessness, because it was this special game that came out at the right time for a lot of the right people, and they just kind of let it go. And I think there's something beautiful about that they didn't, you know, drive the series into the ground.
Yeah, there is no after. It stands on its own forever is kind of the idea there. Like, most people, when they think of a sequel, they think of, like, something that is supposed to be better than the original, because that's just the nature of sequels. But part of the reason there's not a sequel to Chrono Trigger is that making that sequel that is just better than Chrono Trigger and tells, you know, a different story is so incredibly difficult.
Yeah, and I think they discovered that in Chrono Cross. Even though Chrono Cross got very good reviews and it sold very well, I feel like the experience of that, where they tried to do something different in the spirit of the Chrono series, like, well, if we're going to make a Chrono game, you have to do revolutionary mechanics of some kind. You got to push the limitations on this. I wouldn't be surprised that the experience of Chrono Cross made them realize, let's leave the series alone. It did what it needed to do for the time. It's a very special little game, but you just see what happens with the Final Fantasy series, the Dragon Quest series, where it's just, you talk about that and people are just going to end up debating, well, where did the series go wrong? You know, what were the best games and all that? No, you don't have that conversation with Chrono Trigger. Chrono Trigger is just Chrono Trigger. It's that special little game that came out in 1995 that had a great plot and was a lot of fun to play.
Yeah.
My boomer core self says that Final Fantasy went wrong when they stopped being about the crystals.
Wow, that is a spicy take.
I just want to make a quick recommendation for people who do want a Chrono Trigger style game. There was a game that came out in 2010 by Atlus that captures, I think, the absolute spirit of what Chrono Trigger was about, called Radiant Historia. I highly recommend it.
Yes.
They incorporate a time travel mechanic into it very, very strongly as well. It's a great game.
I have to check that out. I'm a big fan of Atlus. I'm actually just now finishing. I sort of dipped my toe into it at the time it came out, and then hadn't revisited until but Odin Sphere is a action RPG beat 'em up with amazing hand-drawn art. Not the greatest game, but beautiful art, and anyway, we can talk about Atlas another time maybe, because they definitely deserve some discussion. But I was actually not aware. What is it called? Radiant Historia?
Radiant Historia.
I'll make sure to check it out.
It was for the DS, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, it was for the DS, and actually it incorporates some people from the Megami Tensei series, I believe.
We'll definitely check that out. Louis, you had something you wanted to say, yeah.
Yeah, well, before we leave Chrono Trigger, I know the way I played it, apparently it's not the right way to play it, and DK has some deluxe autism on the right way to enjoy it, because I was told that buying the iOS port for $5 was not the way to go.
Boo. Yeah. I mean, this is kind of... Okay, so this actually ties in well with like one last point that I wanted to make. So I'm actually really... I'm very glad that you mentioned this, Louis, but especially because one of the points that I wanted to make was the camera of Chrono Trigger is one of the part of the story. Like, in Final Fantasy games, especially Final Fantasy VI, but really all of them, and pretty much every JRPG of the era... you know, your character is a very small sprite, often kind of disproportionate, in, you know, like a kind of chibi style with a big head and a small body, and
two frames of walk.
Yeah, and you know, very clearly, like the emphasis artistically is much more on like giving you a sense of scale with the environment. And, you know, to the extent that there's good character art and good monster art and stuff like that, it's in the turn-based battles, and all that kind of, you know, like the character models themselves are very much an afterthought. And even where, you know, in the Final Fantasy games where you you're interacting with an enemy, right? Or maybe an enemy appears on screen in this kind of very small sprite. When you fight them in the battle, then that sprite is often much bigger, very kind of, you know, very nice hand-drawn art. But your character models are always the same. You know, you're walking around on the world map, you're a tiny little box. When you're fighting in the battle, you're also a tiny little box. That is not the case for Chrono Trigger. And again, you mentioned Borzoi, the enemies appearing on the map. The enemy sprites in the overworld are the same as the enemy sprites in the battle, and it's the exact same thing for the characters. The character models in the overworld are the same as the character models in the fight. The difference with Final Fantasy is the art. You get a much bigger, like your character model is bigger, more detailed, occupies much more of the screen real estate, and you get a much more intimate feel. It's much more kind of, it emphasizes this design aspect of, we're telling a very an interpersonal story about these characters that are more fully fleshed out than I think in the Final Fantasy, where it's a little bit, you know, the characters are kind of interchangeable to a large, much greater extent. So as far as like the port or how to play this game, you know, again, we mentioned the Dragon Ball Z and all this kind of stuff. Like, the artwork is really, really good. It's really, really good. And I think it needs, personally, this is my weeb autism or whatever coming into the thing. Like, I think it should be enjoyed. Like, the Super Nintendo does it's perfectly adequate to the task. And I guess there's some, there's some, like, you know, you can, if you played on an emulator or certain Super Nintendo type systems, you know, you can get kind of like a little bit of rasterizing or whatever it is that makes the graphics look a little bit better without actually like affecting the original design. The iOS port was garbage. It's all compressed, the colors are all messed up. I mean, if you can really, you just pull up like screenshots side by side, you can tell it's just an inferior product, and tries to do all these things and fails at making it look good for, I mean, I don't know how it looks on an iPhone, maybe it's okay, but to my eyes, it's just very much an inferior product. And so I would say, you know, rather than the iOS port or the Steam port, if you have some kind of ethical or other objection to emulator, which I really would 100% say is the way to play, the DS port is very good also.
Okay, that's the version I played. So.
Yeah, the DS port is of the ports, it's the closest. There was also a PlayStation port, which was also kind of garbage. It wasn't quite as...
That one because of the cutscenes.
The cutscene, yeah. So that was the coolest thing about that is it has these like these anime, like fully animated cutscenes with the characters. It looks rad. It's not very long, but so what? It's a couple of, you know, minutes of animation with the Chrono Trigger characters, like fully drawn out, animated. It's great.
It's like Dragon Ball, basically.
Yeah.
Less flying and fighting, but still Dragon Ball.
But yeah, so I would say that either the DS port or on an emulator of some sort is the way to play.
So the iOS port is for Chrono Niggers.
Indeed.
Been sitting on that line for a while.
That's great.
Been sitting on that line for a long time.
But yeah, so that was what I wanted to say about the artwork and how to play the game and that kind of stuff. What else do we want to say here and now? Because I think there's enough here in terms of, like, you know, obviously we should get together again and we can continue this series on JRPGs.
Okay.
I know you
possibly wanted to talk about Xenogears, but I don't know if I'm ready to talk about the crucifixion of that pink thing again.
Yeah. I can actually make a statement on, like, how the design of Chrono Trigger actually greatly influenced every game after, basically.
Yeah, definitely.
Where the ending of Chrono Trigger is so memorable for people because it just throws you into the same world you've explored already. It's like giving you a tour of a theme park and then telling you at the center of it, go wild at the end. And
that's
a lot of modern games try to replicate that, especially MMOs, but the issue is that they're just the theme park. There's nothing leading up to the, you know, telling you to go wild. It just tells you to go wild from the start, and it feels empty. And that's why a lot of people complain about MMOs just being theme parks, effectively, when you compare them to, like, an actual handcrafted story of an RPG that's meant for one person to experience by themselves.
Yeah, the only game that I've gotten that real, like, kind of you go buck wild feeling was if you ever do, like, New Game Plus in Mass Effect, because you basically you're just stomping through dudes, and it's very similar. A lot of games, I think, when you do New Game Plus, I think Dark Souls kind of notoriously makes everything harder again. Like, it's basically another difficulty run, so it's not actually any easier. If that makes sense.
Yeah,
until your
it
seventh
just tells
time
you, through, do it again.
Yeah, and then until your seventh time through Dark Souls, and I think it stops, the difficulty maxes out at 7, New Game Plus 7 in Dark Souls. Anyway.
I guess what makes, I completely agree with Pitcraft, what makes Chrono Trigger amazing for me as well, though, is building on his analogy there, it's not just the... you get to go buck wild in this theme park, is that while you were touring this theme park, you were introduced to the various people who operate the machines, and they don't seem to mean much. Like, it's like, oh, that's just a guy who works there. When you're let loose on it and you actually do take the time to explore, you find that a lot of those people have a lot more depth to them, that, or perhaps the guy who's operating your ride is actually from a different time period and ended up here by accident. That's actually one of the best low-key things about us, such as the revelation of where the three gurus came from, that Melchior, this guy who's helped you build swords in the game, is actually from the timeline of Zeal, because it's in many games it would be obvious, like, oh, this character's got a deep, dark secret, and maybe you're going to find that out probably sooner rather than later, unless it's got they're trying to do some kind of crazy twist to it. But no, with, like, the character Melchior, for instance, you find out later, oh, this guy who makes these amazing swords, he's actually one of the three gurus. And it's done in a very subtle and understated way, many of the revelations in this game. And that's kind of what makes it enjoyable, as though you just discovered that yourself. That's what makes it so fun, is that it makes you feel like you're discovering the stuff. It gets you to think about these existential questions and to see these interactions and to create those interactions, but it doesn't feel forced at any time. It feels organic.
Similarly, like, the side quests are just there. There's not some person who tells you, go to this cave, kill this thing, get the goodies. It's just, you travel around, you see something you couldn't get to before, and you're just like, oh, what's here? And you find the thing, and get something from it.
It also lets it also lets you play around with, like, you know, do things kind of. It feels like it gives you a little bit of avenue to explore. Like, you know, I remember, being however old at the time, like thinking, like, what if I did this? And like the game lets you do that and sort of like rewards you for coming up, you know, in hindsight, it's kind of obvious, or it's like an obvious thing to try. But then like it doesn't hold your hand. It just sort of, it doesn't even really necessarily provide any hints in that direction. It's just sort of, you know, if you understand the mechanics or paying attention even a little bit, it's clear that, you know, oh, maybe I could try this. And then the game lets you try that and rewards you for trying it. It's really quite well done.
They reward you for caring about the characters, and that's what's so astounding to me. It seems, again, going to like the Seinfeld isn't really that funny type problem. It for the time when it basically did this, it was an amazing thing. It made you, if you worked, they reward you for working at caring for these characters. Because I just remembered, you have a side quest again. Now all this stuff's optional. You don't need to do any of this stuff, and they give you some minor prompts so you know about it. But you got to do all the legwork yourself and figuring out what happens with all this. But you have the character of Luca, for instance, who's got guilt over what happened to her mother because her mother can't walk anymore because of an experiment that went wrong. And if you follow the right sequence where you end up, you use the fact that the robot in your party, can, you know, live for hundreds of, you know, operate for hundreds of years. You plop him down. There's this woman who wants a forest to grow where a desert is. So you plop Robo down in a previous time period and let him basically work the earth so that when you go back to pick him up in 1000 AD, 400 years later, there's a lush forest there. Life, you know, there you're actively improving the world and the continent you're on is after you guys pick up Robo, there's this cutscene where everybody's sleeping and Luca wakes up and there's a unique little time portal that's manifested that allows her to go back in time and prevent her mother from having her legs destroyed. And there's not a huge plot relevant thing to that. The only thing you really get out of that in terms of like what you see in the game is later on in the game, you see her walking around. There's not like this big, you know, emotional scene where, oh, I fixed the time period and I fixed this little thing and I get like a treasure for that. No, it's just a very, very small thing that you help.
You've improved one person's life, really.
They don't dwell on it. It's just left understated and it's a character moment that you earn. And that's what the subtlety of that is what makes it such a fantastic game, because so much of video gaming hits you over the head with very explicit storytelling. And the only other game that I really know that has been able to do that very, very subtle storytelling is the Earthbound series, and that's because that's written by an actual writer.
Yeah, we're gonna have to do Earthbound is gonna be its own episode, of course. And on that note, boys, I think that's a really, really great point about the subtlety, and it literally is like, and it's not even thematized, really. It's just something that you would notice, that like her mother can't walk. She's always in a wheelchair or sitting down. And then in the future, after you sort of fix this problem, she's just walking around, and it never even comes up. Why would it come up? Because in the fixed timeline, there was never an issue with her legs. So why would it be noteworthy that she can now walk around? But if you were paying attention, you would notice like, oh, wow, her mother's walking around. And that gets to something else I wanted to say.
Just building on that point, because in a lot of games where you have these emotional interactions between characters, what would happen is, okay, Luca comes back from time after fixing that, and the party confronts her, and they have this big group hug moment. That never happens. That's a private moment you share with you and that character.
Mm-hmm.
That's just between you and Luca. It doesn't. They don't dwell on this with the party having a big group hug thing about, oh, we didn't know. You know, we didn't know that you wanted to help your mom and all that. No, they don't. None of that requires any explanation. None of that requires any exposition. None of that requires the group hug moment where the party learns the power of friendship and working together.
Yeah, and that actually is an improvement to the writing, because a lot of modern games would force that group hug, but then you have someone like, you know, someone who wouldn't really care for the person. Like, just, they'd have to write them saying something, but why would they care? This kind of thing.
Yeah.
On that note, also of the sort of like the interaction between the author, so to speak, and the player, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I think it may be worth going just a little bit more detail into the way that they're playing with tropes about actual real world history. Again, as we mentioned, the game opens in what they call 1000 AD, which is kind of an interesting, like, quasi present day setting, but it's set in 1000 AD. And the first place you go back to is 600 AD, which is kind of a medieval setting with magic and monsters. Very, like, so right off the bat, it's like, okay, well, we're not exactly on Earth, but it's clear, like, you know, there's a recognition in the so-called present day of 1000 AD that, you know, there used to be this, we used to have this problem with monsters, but we don't have this problem anymore. You know, thankfully the monsters are all gone. We won the race war, and now we get to live in peace. On the one hand, you know, it's a very straightforward way to introduce this, like a gameplay mechanic where, yeah, you know, obviously one of the first things you're going to do in pretty much any RPG is go and fight monsters, right? Maybe that's all you ever do. On the other hand, it's playing with the player's expectations of, like, cause there's a kind of a, how to say, I think operating in the background here is a sense of, like, yeah, that, you know, even if you're like a Reddit fedora atheist type, like, even for those people there, and to say nothing of the rest of us, there's a kind of implicit understanding I think we have of, like, you know, or the narrative that we like to tell ourselves, I guess. The narrative of modernity is, you know, there was the Dark Ages where there was, like, all these bad things going on, and whether or not you believe in, you know, magic and sorcery and witches, like, people at the time did, right? But now we've, like, vanquished all that stuff and we don't have to deal with all those kinds of problems. And so it's playing with this expectation of, you know, like this idea that in the past we had magic and monsters and all these things we needed to worry about, but now those problems are solved. But rather than have it be kind of like a materialistic read, it's like, no, but what if, like, you know, in a very literal sense, there were, you know, skeleton monsters and goblins with swords that we had to, like, beat on the head until they exploded and gave us gold coins, right? And they do a very similar thing with this, we mentioned, like, the prehistoric race war between the humans and the dinosaurs. I actually think, like, I could be wrong, or I don't know, it doesn't really matter, but I was, you know, into science and evolutionary biology enough at the time to, you know, be aware of, and I'm pretty sure this was intentional on the designer's part, you know, in terms of evolutionary biology and science as we talk about it today, you know, it's just a sort of the way that these things are presented is the dinosaurs ruled the Earth. And then, whether because of a comet or a meteor, probably that was what happened. There was some, you know, kicked up the ash, and the dinosaurs all died. And then the only thing that survived was these little mouse-like creatures, the precursors to modern-day mammals. And then it was the age of mammals, culminating in the age of man. That's like the scientific kind of version of events. In a very similar way that they're playing with the kind of the expectations and the psychology of how we in the late 20th, early 21st century sort of conceptualize the mythos or the cultural narrative of the medieval times. They're doing a very, very similar thing with, like, you know, caveman versus dinosaur tropes. Obviously, you know, from the perspective of modern science, cavemen are, you know, millions of years after the last dinosaurs, hundreds of millions of years after the last dinosaurs. But they're playing with this caveman versus dinosaurs trope in a way that incorporates this scientific historical narrative of, you know, the dinosaurs ruled the Earth, the comet came, it blew away the dinosaurs, and then it was the coming of the age of the mammals. And very similar thing again with, we kind of mentioned, I'm trying to be a little bit cagey both for Lewis and for anyone who may be listening who hasn't played, but there's a, you know, there's a kind of ancient Hyperborea type civilization, 12,000 BC, which is like, that's like again, these designers know what they're doing, because that's like the time frame that people who are into this kind of stuff talk about, that those kinds of civilizations actually having existed. And so it's a kind of very interesting what if of a kind of like a, you know, Atlantean type civilization that, you know, disappears for plot reasons. And, you know, it's these time periods. And then, of course, we mentioned also the post-apocalyptic, and they play with all kinds of post-apocalyptic tropes. The time periods are not arbitrary. They're like archetypical in terms of our late 20th, early 21st century cultural narratives and self-understanding of ourselves in relation to these other kinds of cultural contexts and the stories that we tell about them. And it does very, very interesting and very sophisticated things with those tropes.
Yeah, no disagreement there.
Yeah, you could describe it as like trying to blur the line between fiction and reality, but in a way that's not overwriting reality with fiction, but just making you ask the question of, you know, is that real? Is that what happened? Etc. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like an alt history in a certain sense of like, you know, because if you want to go full, you know, Phantom Time, you know, conspiracy, whatever about like various things, you could almost ask like, I mean, and I think it's sort of designed to get you to ask like, well, what if there was an ancient Atlantean civilization that disappeared? What if, you know, there was some kind of magical race war against, you know, these kind of dark forces in the medieval period that were suppressed but not completely disappeared, that are then starting to reemerge in the modern day? What if there is a kind of, you know, post-apocalyptic scenario or these kinds of things? It's designed to get you sort of, you know, it's a very interesting combination of a kind of suspension of narrative disbelief with also getting you to think about, you know, like it's almost, you know, it's 1 foot in a kind of completely different fantasy world and 1 foot in, quote-unquote, the real world.
Yeah. As in, I don't really have anything else to add to this.
Yeah, I don't know. We've gone on for a little bit now, and I think this is fine. This is great. That may even be a good place to end. I don't know if we had other observations we wanted to make or things we wanted to say either about this or this kind of era of JRPGs generally.
Yeah, I can't really think of anything aside from just reaffirming. Play Chrono Trigger. You've got nothing to lose.
One thing I'll mention, I guess building on DK's thing here, is this is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about JRPGs, is because the way that the Japanese approach RPGs, they can't escape the Western influence. Period. Basically, if you actually look at the amount of JRPGs, there's very, very few of them that set their, you know, any of their stuff within the Sengoku Jidai period, which is the, you know, the Warring States period of Japan, probably the most famous samurai period of Japan. There or any other feudal history. There are some, obviously, there are some JRPGs that are set in that time period, but the vast majority of JRPGs have this quasi Western influence on it. To the point, like, we see, like, a Persona series where they just straight up take a lot of Western demonology and mythology and incorporate them as spirits to summon into the game. But when they try to do an antiquity or a medieval time period, they draw very heavily off of the Western influence, but they interpret it in their own unique way. It is funny at times how much they get accurate and how much it's their own personal conception of it. And I think because they don't feel they're fascinated by our history, but then because it's not their history and they don't feel beholden to it, they're not slavish to trying to create this, you know, almost like an Ivanhoe type idea of what the past was like. They see these as interesting aesthetics, interesting set pieces, an interesting spirit, you know, an interesting zeitgeist that they would like to emulate on some level within their media. And it kind of frees them up to do interesting things with that. I don't know if you'd see like a Hyperborea-type situation in a Western RPG, because the funny thing is that they're, you know, you can see nefarious influence with that, but you can also just see it as they want to create their own fictional worlds and not be tied down to our history, whereas the Japanese are willing to play with our history.
Well, also, they have a lot less priors, a lot less, like, kind of self-programming. One thing you notice in JRPGs is that there's a lot of, like, kings and peasants and knights and things, but you don't get, like, the trope of, like, dirty, filthy, gross peasants, because that's not really programmed in the Japanese.
Yeah, whereas they in America, have, like, high fantasy, noble, bright stuff.
Yeah, we're kind of programmed to think of, well, as before the Enlightenment, everybody's dying of plague and, you know, and they're just a different set of, you know, tropes.
Whenever I've had to explain what archaeofuturism to somebody what it is. I just call it Final Fantasy nationalism. Because I mean, am I wrong though? I mean,
no, not at all.
Merging of
not at all.
You know, of good concepts of the past with technology that's indistinguishable from magic. To me, that's just archaeofuturism.
Yeah, there's maybe a place. I think we should, you know, this episode I think people will enjoy it. I certainly have enjoyed having this discussion. I think it's worth revisiting Final Fantasy as a series in a separate episode. But one of the things
we do need to do an episode on Gnosticism and Xenogears. Though.
Yeah, that for 100% yes. And I actually bounced off of the Xeno. I was an enormous fan of Xenogears and bounced off of Xenosaga like midway through the second game. So maybe I could revisit it or see. I don't know. We'll have to. See, but yeah, that definitely deserves its own discussion, and a lot of these topics deserve their own discussion. But real quick on this note, I think it is noteworthy, and Chrono Trigger does this too, although it has a way within the world design of kind of making providing an internal narrative context that makes sense of this kind of like quasi steampunk, like you have, you know, in the so-called present day, you have more or less present-day technology coexisting with swords, and I guess magic had kind of gone extinct, but people aren't that surprised when you cast a fire spell either. So it's a kind of interesting like thing going on there, I guess.
It's kind of like an early modernization thing where like they haven't gotten machinery quite down, but some people have used it for things.
Yeah, and Luca, you know, we mentioned this character. She's the, you know, the kind of the resident inventor archetype character. Very interesting, kind of not at all feminist. I guess maybe this would be worth going a little bit into this. Like so you have two main, I guess, two female characters that you play most of the game. You later on get a third, who's a cave woman and extremely powerful, but
and the best.
Yeah, but you have, like, in their own way, two well-thought-out female characters. One is the princess we mentioned, who's, like, a kind of a love interest, but she's also, like, it could have easily been a 90s girl power kind of thing, but just wasn't.
She's just headstrong. She's not girl power. She's just headstrong.
Yeah. Yeah, but in a very believable way, and it makes perfect sense within her context, and I, you know, she, I guess, doesn't have that much interesting going on, but is definitely, you know, a good character, well written character. And then Luca, who has glasses, is kind of like, obviously not as attractive. Marl, the princess character, is, you know, blonde and very obviously designed to be, you know, attractive. Luca is, whether, you know, clearly she's too, she cares more about her inventions than her personal appearance. She wears glasses. She, you know, is supposed to be smart. She's the tech user, and she has all the, you know, the inventions we mentioned. And it's another case of, like, without doing, until this very discussion just now, it never occurred to me to try to fit Luca within this, like, women in tech type of narrative. I still wouldn't try to fit her in that narrative. I'm just, I guess, bringing it up because, like, it's so clearly, like, I mean, I guess maybe they're playing with
that. If you
don't,
someone will.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
She's literally an engineer who can build an actual time machine or right. It's not even a time machine at first. She builds an actual transporter. If she's capable of that, yeah, you kind of have to give that to her. But what's interesting, though, I'm glad you brought that up because it didn't even occur to me, that outside of Ayla, who is this very anachronistic character anyways, they actually, in a battle sense, what the women do makes sense as well. Marl uses a crossbow and Luca uses a gun. You do not have, other than Ayla, who, again, is very anachronistic as a character, they're not going up there, like, beating up enemies. They are using technology, projectile weapons that, you know, and magic. So, I mean, I'm trying to analyze a realistic view here of a fantasy game, but this is actually why this game's so strong, because it takes actual fantasy conventions and doesn't do this neo D&D idea where, well, stats don't really mean anything. A woman can have an 18 strength and beat up guys constantly. No, like they're using their cleverness and their technology and their magic to be effective in battle.
They're also explicitly support, in terms of the design, support characters. Like they're not, yeah. You know, with the exception of Ayla, which I'm personally convinced I'll have to see. I mean, I don't know how I would verify this. It may just not be verifiable. So we mentioned the third female character in the group is Ayla, this cave woman, who's like a tank and beats the shit out of your enemy. She's actually extremely powerful and one of my favorite characters to use, at least for big sections of the game. The thing is, so there was this Alex McNabb in a recent Tedious mention. I guess Mike didn't get the reference, but he said Snoo Snoo. So Snoo Snoo...
Oh, no.
You can tell where I'm going with this. Snoo Snoo is a Futurama episode where you have these like giantess Amazonian cave women who are like chaining up the male characters and just like having their way with them sexually, which is, you know, what I guess the Urban Dictionary defines Snoo Snoo as like endless sex forced on a man. The thing is, in its original context, is like literal, and maybe I'll incorporate this in the YouTube video or something, but. Like it's giant Amazonian cave women like just physically dominating men that they're using for sexual pleasure.
This is the shit I was memeing before I met my wife.
Right.
If people remember my the way I used to tweet about tall women on Twitter.
Yes. So I am personally 100% convinced that the Futurama writers who do this scene, I'll maybe incorporate this editing in the thing, got it from Chrono Trigger, because I am not aware of this trope, to the extent it's even really a trope as opposed to just kind of a singular thing of like, you know, this kind of very physically powerful, strong, beat up people, cave women, like, and it's not exactly that she has a sexual relationship with Chrono, but there is some kind of like,
yeah, I think there's an implication that like she wants you to be her husband or something like,
yeah,
that.
And Marl, yeah, gets kind of jealous and exactly. So I think this trope comes from Chrono Trigger.
I can't remember his name, like Kano or Kato or whatever his name is,
yeah,
the one
her
who ends
brother.
Up. No, it's not her brother. It's her. It's the guy who's actually interested in her, because they get married at the end. Yeah, no. It's, and the implication as well is that Ayla is, I mean, she would have to be just by how this genealogy would work. She's the direct ancestor of Marl and probably a lot of the characters. But
yeah.
You know, she finds Chrono to be strong and wants Chrono to be her mate, and then because. The other guy, I think it's Kano, I can't remember his name though, he ends up like temporarily like kind of like betraying because he's jealous,
right? Yeah that, and he's jealous of Chrono, exactly, because of Ayla's interest. So yeah, I just thought that was a funny, like, when I heard, when Alex was like, "It's Snoo Snoo," and Mike was like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" I knew exactly what he was talking about, and it made me think of it. Always when I saw that scene on Futurama, it made me think of Chrono Trigger, and I'm again certain that that's where it comes from. Anyway, just a fun little aside.
Well, I mean, not to. I'll just go. That's bullshit, but I believe it. But, I mean, the idea of the Amazonian cave woman is ever since they've tried to do media depictions of the historical mythological Amazons, they've done that before as well.
But with like, but with
you guys have always wanted that big mommy GF.
But on the counterpoint, I would bet $100 that every single writer Futurama played Chrono Trigger.
Exactly.
So
it's possible. There is actually one of them. I'm looking at them. Well, there is one that kind of has the same hair as Ayla, actually.
Yeah, I'll put the scene in
the timeline just lines up where,
exactly.
If you're a writer on Futurama, you probably played that when you were at Yale or whatever.
Anyway, okay, I can't think of anything else off the top of my head. Did we have any other?
I think this is a good place to kind of put a pin in it. Maybe.
Oh yeah.
One last thing, because we didn't really talk about the music as well. Go listen to the soundtrack, yes, by Yasunori Mitsuda. It's a fantastic.
Yes. Yeah, especially the 12,000 BC theme, I think, is iconic. And there's a funny kind of like terribly done version I've seen on 4chan. I don't know. Maybe you may recognize it once you've done it. If you hang around 4chan and be like, oh, that's where that comes from. That's I think my single favorite track, but there are others, and I mean it's all just really, really good.
To Faraway Times. Go listen to Faraway Times. Fantastic.
Yeah. Speaking of the soundtrack, like a lot of people like to talk about RPGs and how like eventually the battle themes and such will just get to you because it's the same song the entire game. Chrono Trigger's battle theme is timeless. You could never get sick of hearing it.
Never is a long time, but yeah.
Yeah. Especially the boss battle themes are fantastic.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's just, I think, you know, yeah, maybe to cap it off, like the music, the art, the writing, the gameplay design, you know, you could maybe nitpick around the edges of certain particular things, a lot of which is just, I mean, we're talking about a cartridge of a couple megabytes, you know? It's important to keep that in mind, I think, when discussing these older games. But even with those technical limitations, it's a real gem, and I agree with you, Borzoi, that it's a quiet blessing that with the exception of Chrono Cross, which I guess I really think the less said about it, the better, you know, it basically stands on its own as an artistic product, and then we get to enjoy it to this day. So if you haven't for some reason, then, you know, if you have some spare time and like, if you absolutely insist on paying for your thing, then yes, it's like $5 on Steam. Definitely check it out. All right. We'll close it here. Thank you very much. Thank you, Lewis, for coming on. Sorry I missed you in the intro at the beginning. Thank you. I just was so excited to have our special guests, Pitcraft and Borzoi, and I really hope that you all will come back. We mentioned Persona, we mentioned Earthbound, we mentioned Final Fantasy, and later JRPGs, but I think for kind of first episode in this, like, you know, self-contained series within the broader National Institute of Gamer Review, then I think this works really well. And yeah, hope you all can come back.
Oh yeah, I'd love to be back on for especially like anything having to do with Megami Tensei or Persona.
Yeah, for sure we'll do that. Okay, till next time, take care everyone. Dumb girls are